Radio DePaul is proud to bring you the DePaul Writer Series, featuring professional authors and student writers discussing their written works. And now, the DePaul Writer Series on Radio DePaul.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining me on the DePaul Writer Series this morning. My name is Derek Peters. Happy spring to you. It seems that things are warming up a little bit. We got some rain this week, but I'll take it if it means higher temperatures. I'm excited this morning to welcome Kafir Lozzato, author of Extra Life, Inc., who's calling in all the way from Israel, is it?
Yes, that's where I am.
Oh, wow. So you said it was like 6 p.m. in Israel?
Yes, that's the time difference.
Oh, man. And how warm is it over there right now?
It's pretty warm. It's summer. Not in, probably in your terms, it's summer. For Israel, it's still early spring because, you know, summers are very hot here.
But, yeah.
It's very nice. Very good time of the year.
Well, that's great. Kafir, I was wondering if you could tell, give the listeners who haven't read the book just a general overview of sort of what the book is about.
Well, the book tells a story which is based on true events, actually things that happened to me. I should start by saying that in everyday life, I work as a patent attorney.
Yeah.
And the story of the book has to do with a high-tech scam. Someone who allegedly invented a treatment, a cure for cancer. But that's where the real story ends. Afterwards, it becomes a thriller. People die. And the narrator has to run all over the place, to Eastern Europe, to the U.S., to Europe, trying to figure out what's going on. He eventually does. I'm not sure he's extremely happy with what he finds.
Yeah, so that actually happened to you as a patent attorney? Someone came to you with a high-tech scam that claimed to be the cure for cancer?
Yes, but that happens fairly often.
Really?
Yeah, people come to me. Well, and you know, I'm wiser now. That happened a long time ago. At that time, we look at his data, and the data looked good. And we said, okay, this is probably not going to happen, but even if it's, you know, one in a million, and it turns out that he has something, and it is not going to cure all cancers, it's going to cure one type of cancer. And we didn't go along with it. We didn't take part in this adventure, if you want. We will feel very bad and very silly. So we went along for a while. And then we definitely found out that it was a scam and the thing ended. But nowadays, people come with inventions that they allege to pretty much everything. They cure cancer. They cure, I don't know, they can, you can use the product instead of gas to in your car and all kinds of things. But now, as I said, I'm wiser and I recognize the scams.
Well, that's
early
good.
In the game.
Could you talk a little bit about how this particular book came about? I know that you just said that it's based on some real life events, but what made you want to start writing it as an actual novel?
Well, this is a sort of a different book for me because normally it takes me about 9 months to finish a book. This book was 10 years in the making, which is extraordinarily long for me. Because I had this urge to write about it because the whole situation was really had some very special features and hallmarks of the scams. And I think partly that was because I felt silly that I've been going along with this for a little while. Eventually, I wisened up. Took me some time. So I wrote the book again, I wrote it very quickly, but then I looked at it and said, okay, it's an okay book, but it's not good. So I just put it aside and took a look every now and then, every few years, took a look and said, oh, okay, well, it's still just okay. And then in last year, I picked it up and said, okay, now I know how to fix it to make it good, not okay, or so I think at least.
Yeah.
And then I did it. And then I fixed it, and I felt good with it and good enough to let it be published.
So what was it that made you suddenly sort of have this epiphany that you knew what was wrong with this book and what to fix in it? Can you reveal that, or is that a trade secret?
It's not, but it's very difficult to say, because I've done that before. I took the book in my hands and did a lot of tweaking and changes and things, and then read it again, and it didn't work for me. And this time I did the same thing that I've been doing a couple of times before, but this time I read the book and I said, "Wow, that's what I wanted it to be." And I don't know exactly how that came along.
So I'm wondering, it's a very sort of fast-paced kind of thriller novel, and I'm wondering if you started with a clear outline in your initial draft of where it was going, where the story would twist and turn, or if those were things that sort of came about in the subsequent rewrites that you are talking about.
The way things work with me, in thrillers at least, I've been doing a little genre hopping, but most of the time I write thrillers now. The way it works for me, I have a fairly good idea of the main thread of the story. I know where it starts, and I think I know where I want it to end. It's not always true. And then I sit down to write, and the characters take over. It's not something I don't do any planning. You know, I know that many authors do a very detailed planning, and they have all these cards with the various things that are going to happen, and they spread them on the floor or
right.
on the wall. I don't do that. I just sit down and let it come out, and usually works out fairly well. I mean, not the first draft is awful. I wouldn't let anybody look at it, but it's awful. The writing is not good, but the story is already good in the first draft.
You know, now that I hear you talking about listening to your characters talk and having that be the vehicle that drives your writing, so to speak, it's very apparent now that I think about it when reading the book. There's a lot of really firmly established characters, and I noticed that there's a lot of dialogue for, a fiction novel. And so is that something that comes about from being a sort of character-driven writer?
Absolutely, yes. All my books have lots of dialogues in them. Because one of the basic things that I think make a book very good is when you really put something real in it, some real character. Hopefully, you should put some of yourself in the book. And then it comes out genuine, and the characters really want to talk to the reader and talk to one another and make it something that is alive, is not, boring description.
Right. Well, it seems to me that obviously the main character, Richard, the patent attorney, seems to be based off of you.
Much of it, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not autobiographical in any way, but there's some things, some little things in them in that character, and that is me.
I'm wondering, are the other characters based off of real people as well, at least in their sort of most basic form?
Yes, the bad guys. The bad guys are real people. Disguised, of course. I don't want to get sued by them. And the names are different, and some parts of the characters have changed. But if you saw the real bad guys after you read the book, you would recognize them, I guess.
Right. Another thing that sort of took me by pleasant surprise when I was reading the book was how detailed you were in the actual sort of chemical descriptions of things. Did you do a lot of research into medicine and the whole process of building chemical medicine when you wrote this, or was that knowledge that you had previously?
That's something I specialize in, so I didn't have to do a lot of research. I've been doing a lot of work on quite famous drugs, patent work, of course, litigation and things like that. You know, drugs that come to mind is Prozac, Viagra, drugs like that. And so I'm familiar with the pharmaceutical drug development process. And I also work a lot with small startup companies, so I know it from the other end as well.
Okay.
That was the easy part.
what was the hard part then in writing the book? Where did you find the most challenge?
This particular book, the most challenging part was to stay far away from details that would reveal exactly what this was about. Much of it was in the newspapers and many years ago.
Yeah.
It was difficult to write it, to keep the interesting parts in and leave out anything that would identify the people. That was tough.
So separating the fictional story from the non-fictional story then.
Exactly.
Okay, I see. Who inspired the doctor who is trying to obtain a patent for his alleged cure for cancer? His wife is a pretty colorful character, Tamara.
Yes.
Does she have any basis in anybody that you know? And if not, or I guess even if so, how did you go about creating her with all her little eccentricities?
I know a lot of people, and I spend a lot of time when I start thinking about a book, thinking about the characters first, and you could say daydreaming about them, placing them in the environment when the story is going to take place, and growing them and seeing how they will behave, what actions they will have, what they will dress like. That's a lot of work. Nobody sees the work being done because it's in my head.
Right.
It's something I do. At that time I used to fly a lot, so I was spending quality time with the characters on the plane.
Yeah.
It's only up to one point. After a while, the characters take over and they grow without at least an intervention, and I can I assume that subconsciously I'm doing it, but at some point to say, oh, wait a second, I wanted them to, to be tall and blonde, and all of a sudden he's stocky and has black hair. It happens.
Yeah. excuse me. I was wondering do you count that work that you do when you're kind of having it all in your head and fleshing out these characters, do you count that in the time that it takes that you spend writing the book? Like when you say you've been working on this book for 10 years, does that 10 years include all of the time that you spent imagining these characters, like, as you said, daydreaming about them, et cetera?
Well, that part, the first final draft took me about 9 months, 10 months. And that includes all the fleshing out of the characters. The rest of the 10 years was just being, I spent being dissatisfied with the final form of the book and trying to fix it.
Yeah. So what made you go to, do you think that working on other projects in that time when you had set this aside sort of helped you gain a little more clarity about what to do with this particular book?
Definitely, yes. I think since writing this was actually the first thriller that I wrote, and since then I wrote others, and I think the process with each book you learn more, and you develop your craft, and you see things that you didn't see 10 years ago.
Right.
So going back to this book after having other books out, I think helped me a lot to pinpoint the places along the book that had to be changed to make it satisfying to me.
And you've written a lot of books. How many have you published?
I didn't count lately. But I think about six.
Yeah, that's a lot. So do you just sort of continuously, like you finish one project, start on the other? As you said, it usually takes you 9 months. How do you manage that time? Does it go in spurts in terms of when you have inspiration, or do you just sort of force yourself to write on a consistent basis?
I force myself as much as I can. Unfortunately, I run a fairly complex business, so sometimes it takes precedence over writing. At least what I'm trying to do is to work on a single book until I'm done with the first draft, and then when it's just a matter of working on more advanced drafts, I can start another one. That's what I normally do.
Right. Okay, well, it's time for us to take our first break here on the Writer Series. If you have a question for Kfir Lozotto, please text it into our studio line at 773-325-7341. That's 773-325-7341. And I will ask him that at the end of the show. So when we come back, Kfir is going to read an excerpt from Extra Life, Inc. And so we'll see you in a couple of minutes. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Writer Series on Radio DePaul. I've been talking to Kfir Lozotto, author of Extra Life, Inc. And right now, Kfir is going to read an excerpt from Extra Life, Inc. Kfir, is there anything that you want to say to sort of introduce this passage?
Yes, this is a passage well advanced in the book, but there are no spoilers here. Richard and Anne, Richard, who is a narrator, and Anne, who is a journalist that accompanies him, travel to Eastern Europe to look for clues. So 8 o'clock in the next morning, Soas checked out of the hotel with self in bad mood after a restless night on a hard and unfriendly mattress. Anne, in contrast, looked rested and fresh. And as before, I was amazed by her adaptable disposition. Breakfast had consisted of a hard-boiled egg, some tasteless vegetables, and a gorgeous-looking cottage cheese that let you down by tasting sour. The bread could have been the twin brother of the stale loaf that had been served to us the night before. Livio was at the door, as promised. He was a sleek character with a hunting cap, a large gold ring on his little finger, and a black leather jacket. I realized immediately that Georgescu's notion of an English-speaking driver differed diametrically from mine. Bunia dimineata, he said, which I guessed meant good morning or something along those lines. Me leave you, he continued informatively. You, Mr. and Miss. We admitted to being Mr. and Miss and gave him our minimal luggage to load in the trunk. Encouraged by our friendliness, he became loquacious. We, you, I, go Jimbolion car, he explained, probably wishing to relieve us of any anxiety about the ability of the car to get us there. The car was indeed a Mercedes that didn't inspire much confidence. To my untrained eye, it looked at least 12 to 15 years old, and the upholstery was greasy and torn. The floor in the seat beside the driver had partly rusted away, and I could see the road through holes in it. In the back, a little pool of water rested on the floor, awaiting its turn to convert it to rut. Good car, strong, he added, patting the wheel with the palm of his hand when we finally seated ourselves inside with me in front and Anne in the back. Leave you, good driver, you worry not. I leave you, he explained, apparently to make sure that we understood how lucky we were. What road are you planning to take? I asked, trying to get on a more practical level. Excuse me. No entelega inglesa. Thank you. I leave you. Good driver. Now go. He threw in the clutch, and the car moved. He said that he doesn't understand English, Anne said in amazement. I can't believe that. I hope that he knows where we are going, I said. We'd better follow the road on the map, said Anne. Our first stop was a town called Pitesti. A reasonably good road took us there uneventfully. When we got there, however, Livio stopped the car near a mechanic shop and turned to me. Car tired, he said with a smile. What do you mean? I asked. I didn't trust him at all, particularly after Georgescu's warnings. See, he said, pointing at the heat level. It was deep in the red. Wait, he added, getting out and walking quickly toward the mechanic who stood nearby. They talked for a while, with Livio gesticulating every now and then. Eventually, he walked back to the car, still with a broad smile on his face. No worry, e-car fix, we food, he added, pointing to a nearby place that I would never have guessed to be an eatery. It was noon already, and I was beginning to feel peckish. I looked at Anne, who shrugged. We started walking toward the eatery, but were stopped by Livio's frantic cries. No, no, take bag. No, leave here, good bag. Bag, take you. I help, he added, opening the trunk and lifting my bag from it. La rivedere, he added in the direction of the mechanic, and we crossed the street and got into the eatery. From behind the counter, a fat woman of about 50 gazed at us without apparent interest. Livio spoke quickly with her and then gestured us to a table. The woman started bringing bread and other food. This seems to be a fixed menu place, I told Anne, seeing that our friend here didn't bother to ask us about our preferences. Just like those pricey places in Manhattan, said Anne, smiling. You get what they want to give you, and you like it. Let's hope the price is right, I said, kidding back. We had some time to kill, and I could see no point in being sour. Leave you, asked Anne. How long will it take for them to fix the car? Eh, he said. The car, Anne repeated patiently. How much time for the mechanic to fix it? Ah, exclaimed Livio with understanding. Soon, he said. We sat in there for almost 3 hours before the mechanic came to fetch it. The fat woman didn't seem to care as long as we called on her to get us beverages every now and then. Anne and I spent time talking about everything but our mission, touching on fashion, politics, travel, and family. Livio sat there, looking through us with cloudy eyes, probably not getting any of it. I would have happily gone for a walk, except the weather was cold and it had started raining. And as far as the eye could see, there was nowhere to go but more mechanic shops. We were just about fed up with this place when the mechanic came back. He knocked on the window to attract our attention, and Livio got up and went out. He listened to the explanations of a mechanic for a while, and then a heated argument ensued. They both stood up there, shouting at the top of their voices and gesticulating vehemently. After 5 minutes of this, they suddenly shut up, turned around, and walked toward the shop. 10 minutes later, Livio was back, informative as ever. Car good, he said, with a broad smile. Car fixed. We go, he added, making a sweeping motion with his hands, inviting us to get up. We paid our hostess and walked back to the car.
Okay, thank you for reading that. One of the things that I like about asking the authors to pick out a passage for themselves that they want to read is that sometimes they have it's interesting to hear why they decided to read the passage that they read. And so I'm wondering, Kafir, why did you decide on that passage to read?
Because I think it gives you the part of the atmosphere of the story. I always try, you know, this is a thriller, and people die, and people have cancer, and it's all very emotional, but if you don't put something that makes the story a little funny, a little relaxing, you don't have characters in the story that let you, you know, take a break from the heavy stuff.
Right.
Then the story may become a little too heavy.
Yeah.
And so this is a passage that shows you that even though, you know, they are going, you've read the book, so you know, that they're traveling to Eastern Europe because of tragic events, but still, this is a light passage, and I think it. Those are the parts I like in the books more.
Right. It sort of makes the whole story seem a bit more realistic. If you were to focus entirely on the dense, the dark, and, you know, as you said, the heavy stuff, that's not really like real life. You know, in real life, maybe you're having a bad day, but, you might get into some car trouble with a cab driver that doesn't speak the same language as you do, and that might lead to some funny moments.
Yeah, that's spot on. I mean, for a reader to identify himself with a book, he must feel that this is real life stuff, because if everybody is Superman and or fairies or things like that, then okay, that could be an interesting book, an interesting escapist book. I like those, but it's not true to life.
Right.
If you want the reader to really get involved in something that is more dramatic, because, again, this is a thriller, has to be entertaining, but is also a bit dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to give him some spots of real life, as you said.
I also think some of the humor in this passage comes from, this is pretty far along in the book. It starts on page 218. So at this point, you have a pretty good understanding of who the narrator is and what sort of how quickly he tends to get annoyed at things. And so it's funny. I think it's funnier for people who have read the book up to this point. And so they're sort of seeing, the things that are really just very inconvenient getting in his way, and are sort of imagining how he might respond to it before he actually does.
Right. And he's also, at this point in the book, he's already a little bit pissed off about everything.
Right.
He reacts to things in a different way than he did at the beginning of the book.
Right, yeah. Another one of a sentence that really caught my eye when you were reading it. It was actually in the first paragraph that you read, there was a sentence that said, breakfast had consisted of a hard-boiled egg, some tasteless vegetables, and a gorgeous-looking cottage cheese that let you down by tasting sour. I thought that was just such a great line, because it sort of hints that, nothing in this world is really as it seems. A cottage cheese can look gorgeous, but it might actually taste sour.
Right. And actually, that happened to me in Poland once. I took, in Israel, kids in high school take trips to Auschwitz and things.
Right.
And so I accompanied one of my daughters on one of those trips, and we were given exactly a cottage cheese like that.
Oh.
We were so happy in the morning. And then, you taste it and say, oh, what the hell, where am I?
Yeah. And it sort of, foreshadows the letdown of, the high-tech scam in the book.
Right.
As well. The doctor came to him with this, great thing that seemed, that looked really good from the outside, that seemed like it was going to be this huge, medical breakthrough, and it turned out to taste pretty sour to Richard, all things considered. All right, so I guess I'm sort of amazed by how you were able to sort of dictate the pace of the novel. I assume that this is probably something that came about through the subsequent rewrites that you were talking about in the first segment. But how did you decide exactly when to have, a section like this that's a little less fast-paced and a little more humorous and essentially kind of some comic relief?
Yes. Well, you see, it's rhythm is a big thing in a novel like this.
Right.
And this is not something that comes out, by itself. It has to be timed very carefully. And you're right that it's, it wasn't in the first draft and probably wasn't in the fourth as well. I find myself very often reshuffling chapters and books when I do, you know, advanced drafts, because I see that the rhythm is not exactly what I was planning or what it should be, and I have comic relief too early, or I don't have you know, action early enough.
Right.
And that's you know, it's like. Like playing cards, you take chapters, move them around, you have to make adjustments, but eventually I guess it's like writing music. You want to see your music flowing according to what you have in your head.
Yeah,
that's what it's done.
Yeah, that's such a great comparison. So you just, it's sort of a feel thing for you. You kind of make the determination yourself when you're rereading your first draft.
Yes, definitely. And I normally, the reshuffling of the chapters happens in the second draft. There may be some minor changes. We can take a chapter from somewhere and put it elsewhere, also in an advanced draft. But that, I mean, you need to get the rhythm right in the second draft. Otherwise, all the hard work that you have to put in the more advanced draft is wasted, because if you take a chapter and move it elsewhere, then everything may change.
Yeah. Do you find that you're a good critic of your own work, or do you have do you sort of pass those early drafts along to, you know, some people you trust to read and give you notes on those as well?
No, I pretty much critic myself. Not because I think that other people couldn't do it well, but just because I'm impatient, I can't wait for other people to look at it. When I'm going ahead and doing it, can't wait.
Yeah, I mean that's an interesting explanation. I don't know that I've ever heard an author say that before, but I have a feeling that's what a lot of authors actually feel, and that's what they're thinking. They just won't tell me.
Probably, but you know, it's different from editing. I have I always have my last draft, the final one, reviewed by a professional editor, and I get comments that sometimes require changes.
Sure.
But that's again, it's tweaking. It's not doing the work.
Right.
It's fixing stuff. It's different.
What happens in that editing process? What sorts of things does the editor give you notes on? You know, is it more smaller sort of sentence level issues? You know, there's a comma here when you might not need it, or are there also like more sort of thematic notes as well?
Well, line editing is important, of course, but I also get comments. You know, as a as a reader, the editor looks at it and says, no, it's not clear to me why is he killing that guy right now. And then you look at it and say,
yeah.
I need to put some foreshadowing or something, or I need to add a chapter somewhere to make it clear.
Right.
And I think those comments are really great. You need to, I mean, I don't accept all the comments, but many of them are very useful.
Yeah, you know, you sort of need some distance from the work. You know, if you work on this for, as you said, you know, nine or 10 years, you kind of start to see the story as you're writing it. And sometimes, you know, having somebody else take a look and give you some notes like that gives you a new perspective on it.
Right. Yeah. That's something that I think no writer should publish a book without having a professional editor take a look at it and give comments.
Right. Do you have an editor that you've worked with for, you know, through, you said you published 6 books. Do you have you had the same editor on all of those, or have you found an editor that you gel with, that you get along with, that you've used on multiple projects?
Yes, actually, I had a very good editress in England. Unfortunately, she died after my third book, so I had to find a new one. The last two books, I've used an editor I'm very happy with. So I probably will be using him in the future as well.
All right, that's great. Okay, well, it's time for us to take another break here on the Writers Series. If you have a question for Kefir Lozzato, text it into our studio line at 773-325-7341. That's 773-325-7341, and we will get to those questions in the next segment. Like I said, we're going to take a break. You're listening to Radio DePaul, Chicago's College Connection. Welcome back to Radio DePaul. You're listening to the Writers Series. We've been talking with Kefir Lozzato, author of Extra Life, Inc. And Kefir has given us some insight into a little bit about what the book is about and what went into the book. Now, Kefir, I was wondering what's on the horizon for you as a writer. Do you have a new project that you've been working on?
Actually, I have two projects. One is a thriller, a new thriller, which is I'm more or less halfway through, which I think is going to be an interesting one because it involves some biblical stuff and some international stuff. It's going to be nice. It's provisionally called Exodus 95.
Cool.
That's I assume it will be out by the end of the year. And I'm also working on, you know, I have a, sometimes you need to, as I said before, comic relief. Also, writers need comic relief. So I've started a series, Dave Callaghan, Supernatural Detective. It's a funny sort of dark fantasy stories, but humorous one.
Sure.
And I have two books out already on that, and I'm starting the third one in the near future. So those are the plans for the time being.
I'm wondering, you know, it sounds like you bounce around a little bit in terms of genre. You said earlier that this Extra Life, Inc. is your first real thriller, and so I'm wondering if there's pressure on you from, say, people on the marketing side of things to write in one particular genre? Do you feel pressure to do that and build up like an audience that really loves, say, your thriller books? Or do your agents and marketing people and whatnot really leave it up to you as to what to write about?
Well, it has been hinted to me that genre hopping is not a good thing. But I don't agree. Mm-hmm. And since I'm the one who does the writing and I don't get pressured easily, so I don't think anybody's trying. I mean, genre is a means, is not an end to me. Unless you write for marketing purposes. I mean, if you want to write for the market and not for yourself, then there are other options. I mean, you can write instruction manuals for washing machines. If you want to write fiction, then you should write what you feel that you want to write.
That's good advice for all the writers that are listening. You mentioned that you're working on a book that's part of a series. Given that you said earlier that, you know, a lot of your a lot of the work in your writing is directed at coming up with characters and really, you know, getting to know those characters in your head. I'm wondering what the process is like when you write a book that already has characters that you've established. Is that an easier process, would you say?
It is funnier because this Dave Callaghan character is well established. I know exactly how he thinks and how he operates. So my job now is to put trouble in his way, and I always have to think how to, you know, get him into messes and then eventually out. But planning the messes that I'm going to throw him into is really funny. I have a great time doing that.
Right. and you have to try to think of messes that you could throw them into that would make for the most entertaining way out as well.
Yes. The last book is titled Mice. It's a short one. It's an e-book. It hasn't come out in print. It has about white mice that talk and create a lot of problems for him. it's a funny, but really, if you feel disheartened, you can come to my website and pick up one.
sounds funny. How do you feel about ebooks? I know a lot of authors are sort of split as to, you know, whether they're helping or hurting the writing community.
I think ebooks are great. I mean, I like to. You should see my library. I have tons of paper books, and I love paper books and the smell of it. But as a writer, my mission is to get stories into the hands of readers, and there's nothing that helps more than ebook readers. That's a reality.
Right.
So I feel good about it. I resisted it for a while, like everybody else, but I embraced it now, and I'm happy about it.
Yeah, and it's also, I'd imagine, it's also easier to distribute the writing worldwide via the ebook than it would be to, you know, send and ship paper copies of the book, you know, to all the corners of the world.
Yeah, well, and again, it's cheaper, and you want as sure. many people as possible to be able to buy books. The price of paper books, unfortunately, is high, and not everybody can afford it. Anyone, I don't really care in what form people read my books, as long as they do.
Right. I want to sort of shift focus for a second, just because you have a pretty interesting background as a writer. I think that I read that you were born and raised in Italy, and then you moved to Israel as a teenager.
Right.
So English is not your first language, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Actually, I grew up, as you say, in Italy, and the first language that I learned to read in was French, because we had a French au pair. But we spoke Italian at home, and then they made me learn Latin, so... One day, my father came to me during the summer break and said, "Oh, you need to read this book." And I looked at the book and said, "Well, this is English. I don't read English." He said, "You do, because otherwise you're not going out." And I said, "No, no way. I'm not going to read this book." He said, "Okay, from now on, if you want to talk to me, that will be English." And that was what it was. My father was a naturalized American. He fought in the Second World War in the U.S. Army in the Philippines, and he was a bookworm like everybody else in the house, but he only read English,
mm-hmm.
and I hated him pretty much for it for a long time, but now I really should be grateful.
Yeah.
And so I switched all my emphasis from Italian to English pretty early, about, I think it was 11 years old or something like that. And all my work is in English. Patent work is only English. There's nothing else. So I've probably written by now several million works in English over the years.
Do you think writing a novel in English is the best way to learn how to write and read English?
No, I don't think so. there's a lot of work to be done before you can actually write something that makes sense. But I didn't stop writing in English until I had felt that my written English was good enough.
Yeah.
And of course I was wrong, but it took me a few years to get there. But I think my written English is pretty good.
Well, that's what editors are for, right?
Well, yeah, but they don't correct a lot of my... They do line editing like everybody else, but I feel comfortable. I can try Italian is my mother language. I couldn't write a book in Italian, but I haven't been using Italian for many, many years.
Ah, okay. So what languages do you use on a daily basis in Israel?
We speak Hebrew, but we write and read English.
Oh, okay.
In my line of work, not everybody, but...
Sure. Does it help you to gain more readership, I guess, overseas, writing in English, you think, rather than Italian?
I guess. I mean, the biggest market for literature is in English.
Right.
No doubt about that. One of my books is going to be translated into Italian and put on the Italian market soon. But I don't expect a lot of sales from Italy.
Yeah. All right. Well, Kafir, thank you for joining me today. It was a good talk.
Thanks for having me. That was a great talk.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. You can pick up Extra Life, Inc. On Amazon.com. Where else is it, Kafir?
It's pretty much all over the place. Whoever has access to online. I mean, it's probably you won't find it in the shop next to you, but you can find it everywhere where they sell books.
If you look hard enough for it, you can find it just about anywhere. All right. Well, thank you for listening this morning. Join me again next week at 10 o'clock in the morning. I will have author J.T. Lundy will be joining me live in studio to talk about his book, Happy Utopia Day, Joe McCarthy. So definitely tune in for that. I'm expecting a good conversation there. My name is Derek Peters. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks for listening to the DePaul Writer Series. If you're interested in being a guest on the program or would like a copy of what you heard today, email radiodepaulgm@gmail.com. The DePaul Writer Series is produced at the Radio DePaul Studios in Chicago, Illinois. Thanks for listening, and keep listening to Chicago's College Connection, Radio DePaul.